This is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is August 17, 2010. The time is approximately 11 a.m. I'm accompanied by Tom Krebs of the FCIC and Tom Borgers telephonically, and Mary Haggerty of J.P. Morgan and several Paul Weiss attorneys. We're at the offices of Paul Weiss, New York, for the interview of Ms. Haggerty. This interview will be recorded with the consent of Ms. Haggerty. Could I please get your verbal assent for the record?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, great. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. I'll start. Cunicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I.
It's Tom Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, F-C-I-C.
Mary Haggerty, H-A-G-G-E-R-T-Y, J.P. Morgan Securities, Inc.
Jessica Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, Paul Weiss.
Linda Jens, J-E-N-S, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Kara Goldstein, G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N, Paul Weiss.
Paul Patterson, P-A-T-E-R-S-O-N, Paul Weiss.
Okay. In the way of background, Ms. Haggerty, the FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire. Be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements. At all times, if you mention a proper name, a last name, if you could spell it the first time you mention it. If not, we'll try and remind you throughout. And just make sure that all your responses are verbal, audible, and
okay.
We should be good to go.
Okay.
Mary, thank you for coming in this morning. We really appreciate it. Can you give us a little of your background, please?
Sure. I graduated from college in 1982. I went to the State University of New York at Albany and got a bachelor's degree in accounting. Went to work for Arthur Young, which is one of the big eight public accounting firms. And in 1985, went to work at Bear Stearns. Initially in their back office, I did the operational side of their initial mortgage conduit that they operated in the 80s. Left the firm in beginning of 1989 to move to Cleveland, Ohio, and worked for a small firm there for 3 years. And in 92, came back to New York and back to Bear Stearns, where I worked in the mortgage-backed securities department until the merger with J.P. Morgan. At the merger with J.P. Morgan, I transferred over to JPMSI, the Structured Products Group, also working in the mortgage department. And then in March of this year, transferred within Structured Products to another division that manages the firm's principal investments in delinquent tax liens.
Who was your immediate supervisor at Bear Stearns while you were with the mortgage-backed securities department?
It changed from time to time, but it was Tom Morano, who we just spoke about, and Jeff Verschleiser.
What was your job there at the mortgage-backed securities department? What were you doing for Tom?
I did a number of different things during my tenure there. So when I first started again, the second time in 1992, I was in the whole loan securitization group, which was responsible for securitizing 1-to-4 family residential mortgage loans. I continued in that position and became co-head of that group in 1996. And then in 2001, my job responsibilities shifted when Tom Morano asked me to start up and manage a mortgage conduit.
What was that mortgage conduit?
It was an operation by which a subsidiary of the Bear Stearns companies called EMC Mortgage would buy whole loans, 1-4 family residential mortgage loans from sellers of and originators of these loans and securitize them into mortgages, into mortgage-backed securities, sorry.
And ultimately, were those mortgages to be securitized?
Yes.
How did you go about acquiring mortgages for securitization purposes?
Well, there's a lot of steps to that. The firm employed salespeople that would maintain relationships with the originators of the mortgages. So one step is to find out who was creating them and talk to them about selling them to you. The other thing that you would do to go about doing that is just create the parameters under which you would buy the loans. And so the trading desk would work on that along with the mortgage securitization group.
Did you buy these securities in pools, or did you buy them individually?
Earlier on, we bought the loans in pools. And then in 2001 is when we started. Actually, it was in 2002 where we bought the first ones, but we built the operation within EMC to buy individual loans one by one.
Ultimately, what did you do with those loans that were acquired by EMC that had been acquired one by one?
They also were securitized.
Well, who was in charge of the securitization, and with whom did you work at the securitization desk?
The co-head with me of the securitization group was Baron Silverstein. It's SILVERSTEIN.
Was it Baron?
Yeah, Baron, like Snoopy and the Red.
Yeah.
BARON.
Which loan originators did you utilize to acquire these loans?
There were more than 100 of them, between 1 and 200, I think. And they ranged in size from small originators to large ones like Countrywide and Wells Fargo.
I imagine this was a relatively smaller part of the mortgage market when you're looking at 1-4s, or is that what you said, family?
1-4 family product secured the loans, yeah.
I imagine it was a much smaller group than was in the mortgage industry generally?
Well, I think the largest part of the industry would sell to Fannie and Freddie. Yeah, so this was what we call non-agency.
Did somebody just join on the line?
Yes, this is Nina Stenheim with the Financial Crisis Inquiry.
Can you describe for us the methodology that you use to acquire loans from those originators? Would you take bids? How would you do it?
Okay. There are two basic business lines, and I would describe one as flow and the other as bulk. So we'll start with bulk. Bulk is a situation where the originator aggregates a certain number of mortgage loans for sale. And it could be anywhere from $1 million worth of mortgage loans to $1 billion worth of mortgage loans, again, depending on the size of the originator and their capacity to aggregate these and hold them for sale. And so what an originator that was selling bulk would typically do is have relationships with several investors. And they would send typically an Excel spreadsheet that listed the loans that they were offering and then certain attributes about each of the loans, things like the original balance, the property type, the interest rate, what kind of a loan was it, meaning was it fixed rate or adjustable, those types of things.
That's what's called the tape?
Yes.
Okay.
Except they're not tapes anymore. They're Excel spreadsheets, but yes, the tape. And so they would send the tape out and to several different investors, and they would say, we'd like bids on this by a certain date. And the investors, potential investors, would bid, and the originator would make a selection and award the bid.
In connection with the bid,
mm-hmm.
Was it contemplated that a sample would be done for due diligence purposes?
Yes, and it would either be a sample or every single loan would be looked at.
Did the bid oftentimes or ever specify the size of the sample to be taken in connection with the submission of the bid?
What we typically did at Bayer was a commitment letter that would go out within, say, 24 hours of a trade. And in that commitment letter, we would typically specify due diligence. And it's hard for me to remember exactly, but it would make sense to me that at least in some circumstances, at the time of the bid, we would say how much diligence we were going to do. Meaning the percentage of the pools that would be looked at.
Did the material submitted by the originator also contain reps and warranties, or were those negotiated later?
The reps and warranties would be negotiated later, typically, in the mortgage loan purchase agreement. And then oftentimes a master mortgage loan purchase agreement could be entered into between EMC and a seller. And then if you have subsequent trades, they would be settled via a term sheet. So you'd use those same reps and warranties, same agreement, and then the term sheet would just specify whatever was different for that particular trade.
Was EMC also involved in the origination business, or was it merely a conduit for Bear Stearns securitization process?
EMC was a purchaser and seller of loans. EMC did not originate itself.
Did EMC have internally its own underwriting guidelines?
EMC did publish a set of guidelines, yes.
And those guidelines were available to anybody who wanted to submit a bid to EMC so they knew beforehand what your standards were?
The guidelines were available to anybody that wanted to have them. People could submit bids, or we would bid on product if the seller was approved by EMC.
Did those underwriting guidelines change?
Yes.
Did they change between 2005 and 2006? Well, I'm not going to let you guess. We can just go ahead and look right here. Here, this we're going to use this as exhibit number one.
Thank you.
This appears to be a subprime credit profile, and you'll notice it's revised at the top in 5-1 of 05. And it says on the right-hand side, it says date of last change to credit profile was 5-18 of 05. I think, is that, I'm not sure I'm reading that correctly, revised 5-1-05 or 5-18-05. So there indicates there was at least one that was different than the one we're looking at now in existence before this date. Is that correct?
Well, this is a document that looks like it was prepared by Clayton. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've not seen this document to my recollection. So let's take a look at it.
Well, yes, go right ahead. Look at it if you like, but I want to ask you some questions about it.
Okay.
You'll see under the top heading says client-specific rejects.
Okay.
That means loans that the client, meaning EMC Bayer, would not accept. Is that correct?
It appears to be the case, okay. Yeah.
And it says, unless you advise us to the contrary, we would review, should we review loans to the seller's guidelines? Now, what seller are they talking about at that point? That would be the loan originator, origination firm?
I would assume so. Okay. I mean, I'm guessing a little bit just because I haven't seen this document before, okay. but that would make sense to me. Seller would be who's ever selling to Clayton's client, who's EMC.
Are you familiar with Clayton's ranking of loans?
I'm familiar with a result of 1, 2, or 3 okay. for both credit and compliance.
Are you familiar with a term called 2W?
No.
Well, you will be before the day's
okay.
out.
Okay.
Sounds ominous.
Well, I mean, it's no secret, and it's been published widely. It's just that there were 1, 2, or 3. 1 is accept. 2 is, you know, okay, maybe it's not perfect, but it has compensating factors, and 3 is reject. But what happens is when you get to the 3s, oftentimes the purchaser waives any prior constraints, and they rank them as 2Ws. That's all. But what I'm trying to get at here is that if you look at the first bullet point under the heading at the top, it says DTI.
Mm-hmm.
And that's debt to income?
Yes. And typically, debt to income ratio.
And if you look over here to the right, it says Clayton default is EV3 greater than 60. Is that right?
That's what it says, yes.
But their EMC preferences are EV3 greater than 55. Now, I believe that EV means event value or event 3, meaning it's a reject. If it is over 55 on the DTIs to be rejected.
I believe that's what it means, too.
All right. Are you familiar with those? Are you familiar with the underwriting standards that were in play or in place then at Bear Stearns, do you recall, and EMC during 2005, 2006?
I was at the time, and so my recollection for what they may have been specifically back then, as I sit here today, I don't have a great recall.
Go down the other to the credit score. You see it's three bullet points down?
Yes.
And it says EV3 less than 500?
Yes.
But over here it says depends on bid stips. What are bid stips?
When an originator puts the pool out, a bulk pool out for bid, they may say, the credit score would be one of those attributes that I described. So when EMC would bid that, they bid the pool to the originator, they may make a list of stipulations that goes with that bid. So one of them might be, we won't accept anything with a credit score less than 520, or it may be, we wouldn't accept anything with a credit score less than 500 or 600 or whatever it might be. So that's what this would mean to me, that on an individual trade basis, the instruction to Clayton would be, for the minimum credit score, take a look at the terms of that particular deal.
That particular bid stip that accompanied this particular due diligence review.
Correct.
What were other variables that Bear Stearns would utilize in connection with bid stips? Do you recall? LTVs, CLTVs?
Well, anything that was a loan-level attribute could be considered a bid stip insofar as the originator or the seller is presenting that data, mm-hmm. and EMC is making its bid based on that data. So if there was an LTV of 95% on that tape, EMC is saying by accepting by making a bid that that's okay. Sometimes EMC or the trader may have created a set of bid stips that went in contravention. So the bid stip may have said maximum of 90, even if there was a 95 on the tape. So yes, LTV would certainly be one. Maximum loan amount might be one. Those are the types of things that come to mind.
Well, in fact, if you look here down about the sixth bullet point, it says LTVs or CLTVs over 100%. The Clayton default would be to accept it, but the response here is it looks like Bear Stearns would say reject it unless otherwise specified.
I'm frankly surprised to see Clayton accept that. That is unusual, was unusual at the time in the industry.
What about negative AM loans, which are two lines down from there?
Neg AM loans were a specific product type that you typically did not see in subprime. So it says subprime credit profile. Again, I'm surprised to see neg AM along with subprime.
Going down to the cash out purchases,
mm-hmm.
you see that EV3 is a Clayton default, but the answer, the Bear EMC preferences are to ask Bear Stearns underwriting. I guess that's what that means, UW.
Yes, that's what I would assume it means. Cash out purchase. That's unusual.
Yeah.
Cash out refi is usual. Cash out purchase, I'm not familiar with.
Would there be a series of bid steps or standard, were your bid steps standard, at least with respect to subprime credit debt? Do you recall?
I don't recall, but I would say that certainly things change from time to time.
Do you recall having seen or actually eyeballed a series of bid steps with respect to the credit, subprime credit?
As I sit here today, no. I will tell you back then, I'm sure I did look at them, but as I sit here today, I just don't recall.
Well, if I understand you, that the invitation to bid is received and is accompanied with the tape and the underwriting standards, and your response to that would be, we will buy it under, or we would like to make a bid under these conditions, which may or may not be acceptable to the originator. And among those conditions was the bid steps. Is that right?
Yes.
Were reps and warranties from your side also part of that?
Yes. The bids were always subject to the negotiation of the mortgage loan purchase agreement.
When were the reps and warranties negotiated? Were they at the front end or the back end, or with the front end and amended at the back end depending on the due diligence review?
They were never amended depending on the due diligence review. The reps were the reps. And the way I like to do the business is negotiate them up front before you even have a trade, because then everybody knows how we're engaging, we know how the trade is going to work, and you don't want to do a trade and then have things that might cause you to not settle. So the more of the standard documentation or the documentation required to close you can do up front, the better. So typically, you know, I always advocated that let's get all the reps and warranties negotiated up front, but it didn't always work that way. Sometimes we did a trade and then negotiated the mortgage loan purchase agreement prior to settlement.
The trade, of course, wasn't completed until such time as the due diligence had been completed. Is that right?
Typically, yes.
What were the factors involved in the contingent purchase of this pool? Can you tell me?
The factors
involved. Yeah, I mean, what was it that was contingent? Was it the reps and warranties had to be signed? We had to make certain that certain percentage of loans were, you didn't have X percent rejected loans. What were the tolerances?
Okay, sure. Yes, the mortgage loan purchase agreement had to be negotiated and finalized and signed off on. With respect to the due diligence, typically what we did at Bear Stearns is in subprime, and the due diligence protocol varied by product. So would you like to talk about subprime
specifically? Sure. Let's do subprime, and then we'll come back to others and find out how different they were.
For subprime, we, best of my recollection, we did 100% due diligence. We looked at every loan for credit, what we called credit, which would have been a desk review of the loan file to see if it conformed with the agreed upon underwriting guidelines. There would be a compliance review. There would be a data review, meaning that the loan level information provided on the tape or the Excel spreadsheet matched the documents in the loan file.
Mm-hmm.
And then for subprime, I believe we also did some sort of review of the appraised value of the property. And I don't recall as we're sitting here if we did BPOs or AVMs or drive-bys. I just don't recall what we did.
So you did credit, you did compliance as well.
Yes.
And then you did valuation.
I believe we did on subprime. They were both. What we did at EMC was we would review the originator's guidelines and approve them. We would either approve them as they were, or we would approve them and say, except for these three things, your guidelines are acceptable. And oftentimes what that really was tantamount to was comparing the originator's guidelines to an EMC guideline and highlighting the difference. So in some cases, we were using the originator's guidelines, and then in some other cases, we used the originator's as modified to match EMC's guidelines.
How were those modifications transmitted to the due diligence third-party provider?
They should have been provided by Patty Sears or Don Mongaluzzo as the due diligence managers. And Patty Sears is S-E-A-R-S, and John Mongaluzzo is M-O-N-G-E-L-L-U-Z-Z-O.
Were Patty and John responsible for effecting liaison with the lead person from Clayton?
Yes.
Would they attend off-site reviews with Clayton's?
Typically not.
How was it they would communicate, that is, the due diligence results? How would they be transmitted back to Patty and John?
I don't have direct knowledge of that, but I believe that it would be via email. And I also believe they would have spoken on the phone throughout the engagement.
Were the responses to the bids, we've heard them described as overlays or as tolerances. Do you have any knowledge of the use of those terms with respect to the originator's guidelines, underwriting guidelines?
Overlays?
Uh-huh.
I think overlays, and again, I'm guessing depending on who used the term, but as an industry term, it would make sense to me that overlay was what I just kind of described, mm-hmm. where you're comparing the originator's guidelines that they use to make the loans with, say, your own guidelines and what's different. Just as an example, let's say that the originator would do a 95 LTV to some loan amount, and you would only want to take a 95 LTV to a lower loan amount. So you might say, I accept your guidelines, originator, except that I'll only go to this loan amount for that LTV.
So is it your impression that the materials provided as an overlay, and we'll use that as a term of art, were perhaps more stringent than the guidelines from the originator?
I would say by definition they should be, because if the originators were less, if the originator's guidelines were more conservative, let's say, then the investors, there would be no reason to do an overlay, because by definition that originator's guidelines would be well within the investor's guideline.
That's all I have of that document. What I'm going to show you is going to be marked as exhibit number 2 to your testimony, and that is Clayton. You're familiar with Clayton, obviously.
Yes.
And did you use them as a due diligence firm in connection with preparing or reviewing loans in connection with securitizations?
We used Clayton as a due diligence firm in connection with purchasing bulk packages of whole loans, yes.
This is a document. It's actually page 2 of the document, and there's Bear EMC. And if you'll look at the middle line where it says final rejection rate,
uh-huh.
You see that?
Yeah.
Do you see where the total Bear EMC final rejection rate is? See that is a 9%?
I see 9%, yes.
Do you know what waivers are?
I know what waivers are in the context of Fannie Mae.
Okay. Do you know whether or not a waiver in this context means that notwithstanding that a loan was ranked as 3, that on 42% of those loans ranked as 3, Bear Stearns EMC waived them in and accepted those loans?
I don't know what waiver means on this document.
Well, we have another one that defines
okay.
It. All right.
Sure.
Now, I understood that You say that Clayton did 100, you did 100% due diligence on the loans. Is that right?
I think what I said is that typically for subprime, it was our practice to do 100% diligence, yes.
Are you saying, do you believe then that for the first quarter of 2006 through the second quarter of 2007, that Bear Stearns had due diligence performed on only 72,379 loans? That's on the line right next to the final reject rate.
I don't know how this document was created. I don't know what 2006-1 means, 2006-3 means.
Well, I will represent to you that 2006-1 is the first quarter of 2006.
Oh, okay.
And the second quarter of 2006 and so on until you get down to 2007-2, which would be the second quarter of 2007.
Okay.
And this purports to be, and we have the testimony behind it, to be an amalgamation of all of the due diligence efforts done by Clayton.
Okay.
Now, was Clayton the exclusive due diligence firm employed by Bear Stearns EMC?
No.
Who else did you utilize?
It was a company called Watterson Prime that also during its tenure was purchased by PricewaterhouseCoopers. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they call themselves Watterson Prime and sometimes PwC.
Did you ever use Bohan Group?
Yes, but very early on and just for a couple of transactions.
Did you ever use 406 Partners?
I don't think so, no.
You're familiar with them?
No. I know them as maybe a BPO provider, if I'm remembering right.
Did you use any other, to your knowledge, sitting here today, any other third-party due diligence providers or vendors?
Yeah, I think that we tried one or two transactions with a company called Mortgage Ramp.
Mortgage Ramp?
Yeah, R-A-M-P. And that would have been on Alt-A. And then when we're talking about due diligence and the firms that we've just named, mm-hmm. we're talking about the file review. The valuation work is a separate group of vendors.
I understand. So if, for example, you had a question about the valuation or the appraisal on a home, you would go to one of these firms to ask them to either do an automated review based on their database, or you'd have them send somebody to drive by, or maybe both, to determine the value of the home. Is that right?
On subprime transactions, we sometimes did that, yes. That was not typically done on Alt-A or jumbo product.
Approximately how many transactions did, if you can recall, I know this may be a tough question, how many transactions did Bear Stearns engage in 2006 and through the second quarter of 2007?
I don't recall.
Did Bear Stearns have its own captive origination firms?
Yes.
Who's that?
It was a company called Bear Stearns Residential Mortgage Corp.
Bear Res.
That's right.
Yeah.
Bear Res.
Was Bear Res also a provider of mortgage loans that were subsequently securitized?
Yes.
Was due diligence performed by third-party due diligence providers on the mortgages generated by Bear Res?
We hired staff from the Clayton Group to be on site at Bear Res in the beginning of its operations. I don't recall exactly how long they stayed, so that we could do that due diligence as the loans were being made, rather than wait to have a whole pool. So that continued for some time, and I don't remember how long that continued.
Do I understand to mean that you employed employees of Clayton to come over and assist you or to conduct the due diligence work for Bear Res as the loans were originated?
Yes, in the beginning of the operation.
What happened? I mean, was there a time when that changed?
Yeah, there was, and I don't recall exactly when, but there was a time where The results of those that Clayton review was positive, and we felt that we didn't need to continue that.
So you had brought your staff up to speed to what Clayton knew, and they could do it on their own?
The team that was assembled at Bear Res were very seasoned mortgage originators. But yes, with the startup of any, you know, new origination company, you want to make sure everything is running smoothly. Yeah, and so that's why we did that. Yes.
After the Clayton folks departed, was due diligence continued on Bear Res's mortgage loan origination work?
No.
It was not.
Correct.
And presumably the belief was that the people who were there originating loans had grown up under the who had been overviewed by Clayton and knew what the standards were.
That's right.
From 2003 to 2007, did you ever notice a decline in the underwriting standards in this industry, the mortgage origination business?
2003 to 2007. I noticed in subprime, for example, that over time the maximum loan-to-value ratio that was accepted increased. That comes to mind specifically. And also over time, I think in the Alt-A programs, the same thing. The maximum combined loan-to-value ratios increased to 100% over time.
Do you see any deterioration in the FICO score?
The FICO scores, I would say no. The banding for the FICO scores, in terms of guidelines, my recollection has stayed pretty static. Alt-A tended to be a minimum of 620 at the bottom, with the average around 680-ish. And subprime, I think, varied depending on the originator. I think over time, it became typical to institute a minimum of 500 or 520, whereas maybe prior to that, it was lower. And that had something to do, I think, with the increase in the LTV.
Any other areas where you saw or you observed deterioration on an industry-wide basis?
The other thing that developed was the continuation of the reduced documentation products. So earlier on in Alt-A, you had full doc and stated income.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was added over time was the no ratio product and the no doc product and the no income, no asset verification product.
Any others?
In terms of products themselves, a product that came into the market during that time period were the NEG-AM arms.
What about the 327s and the 228 loans? Did you see a lot of those? And when did they come into play?
327s and 228s were traditionally the adjustable rate component of subprime. So those had always been part of the programs for subprime.
On the DTI, did you use the teaser rate or did you use the ultimate potential increased rate?
To the best of my recollection, the guidelines used the fully indexed rate to underwrite, to qualify.
What number would they use? Would they make an estimate of the number?
An estimate of income?
you're right. You're right. I withdraw that question. I was chasing the wrong trail.
If I could just back you up one second. The 228s and the 327s, they were always in the arms, but did you see an increase in their use during that time as a percentage of your portfolio?
I don't really recall.
Okay. Thanks.
Did you see an increase in the use of the Alt-A's?
The volumes that we bought at Bear Stearns increased from 2003 to 2006, yes, just in general across the board.
When you were approached by an originator wanting to sell a pool, what would you do to confirm or to verify that his underwriting standards were as he represented them? The due diligence process, and that was it?
Yes.
How often would you deal with an originator with whom you had done business before?
So for an originator that sells bulk would bring packages maybe every 2 weeks or once a month, just depending on their the size of their origination book and their warehouse capacity. So I think it really varied. We certainly didn't buy every pool every time. I think at one point during the period, I just recall that we were at like a 20% win rate overall on the bulks that were presented.
I'm not sure I understand that. 20%.
So if 100 pools were presented mm-hmm. to us over a time period,
yes.
we won 20 of
them. Okay, you
and other people won the other 80.
Who were your principal sellers of pools?
And again, would you like to focus specifically on subprime or just
across subprime.
The board?
Yeah, subprime. Let's deal with subprime now.
Okay, I'm sorry. I keep talking in general. Subprime.
And then we'll come back.
We bought a product from Encore. People's Choice. Mortgage IT.
I'm sorry, that was what?
Mortgage IT. AmeriQuest. From time to time, New Century. Those are some of the names that come to mind.
Wells Fargo Home Mortgage?
Wells Fargo was a big customer of the firm on the jumbo and Alt-A side, and so we would have bid their product if they presented subprime to us, yes. I don't recall how much we bought of subprime from them.
Quick Loan Funding?
Yes.
Impact?
Yes.
Impact Funding?
Yes.
Fremont Investment Loan?
Yes, we bought from Fremont.
Community Lending Associates?
Community rings a bell, yes. Whether that was specifically subprime or not,
let's go.
Not sure.
Number three. What I've shown to you is a document, again, the trending reports generated by Clayton. Have you seen these documents before? The trending reports?
I don't recall this document, no.
Was there a point in time where the Clayton folks came to and met with Bear Stearns to discuss the trending reports that you're aware of?
I don't know.
If they had come to Bear Stearns to discuss the impact or the findings of this trending report, whom would they likely have met?
I believe it'd be likely they would have met with John Mongaluzzo.
And John was responsible for the due diligence side?
Yes.
And he was, where was John in the organization chart with respect to your position?
John worked in the mortgage finance department, of which I was co-head. So he reported up to me.
Were you ever made aware of a meeting between Clayton and any person in your operation to discuss the trending reports of Clayton Brokerage?
I don't recall.
Let me ask you to look at the second page of this document.
Tom,
yes.
We were talking before about in the context of subprime.
Yes.
It's unclear here whether this has anything to do with
I think this is subprime as well. But I cannot represent that to you. I do not know whether this is exclusively subprime. I do believe that it is based on all of the due diligence done by Clayton, and it is a document that would have been triggered by the generation of this document, is my understanding. You see the waivers here? It says that Bear Stearns' overall waiver rate 7% compared to Clayton industry average of 11% for all similar reviews performed by all clients for the same period.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you see this? The highest waiver rate among the top five sellers was found on Encore Reviews, while the lowest was found on Fieldstone. Have you ever dealt with Fieldstone, to your knowledge?
Fieldstone was a seller to EMC, I believe. I know that EMC bid their product.
It says that the most commonly waived exceptions for Encore were MA borrower interest outside safe harbor, not client approved. Do you know what that means?
I don't. It's ringing a bell. MA, I believe, stands
You're a lot more likely to know what it means than I am, I will tell you at this point.
MA, I believe, stands for Massachusetts. And the bell that it's ringing is somewhere along the line, states came up with their own individual high-cost lending rules in addition to the national HOPA requirements. So I recall that there was something in Massachusetts, and interest outside safe harbor, not client approved, must refer to that. And it, my recollection is it wasn't clear what the risk of non-enforcement was, if you will. So that could be what that was. I'm very shaky on the details, but I'm just offering you what I think it could be.
With respect to a loan that was, say, questionable, wasn't exactly in the parameters of a reject, and it wasn't exactly an acceptable loan, what were the factors that you might have considered, or Bear Stearns at that time considered, in connection with approving or rejecting those loans?
Okay. One point to that point,
sure.
What we just looked at with Massachusetts is a compliance point.
Right.
The compliance points tended to be pretty cut and dry.
You can't waive those.
It is or it isn't,
yeah.
Right? So the compensating factor analysis that you talked about before with the two would be on the credit side. And so if Clayton coded something as a two, they thought there was a compensating factor. That could be something like the maximum loan-to-value ratio for the program is 75%. The originator made the loan at 80%, but the compensating factor is that the homeowner has $100,000 in the bank. So that's the type of thing that would be evaluated.
Who is it that would have made the decision to accept or reject that loan based on those circumstances you just described?
Well, Clayton came up with the twos.
Mm-hmm.
So they made the decision that there was enough of a compensating factor in the file to call it a two.
Based on what they had been given and what they understood the underwriting guidelines were.
Correct. Correct.
What happens when the threes come up, the waivers?
Well, again, waiver is something I'm not familiar with that term in how we did things at Bear. What would typically happen with threes is that the due diligence firm should present them to the seller, because sometimes threes occur just because documentation is missing. The other thing that we would always want to make sure is that the Clayton reviewer wasn't missing something in the file. So it was typical to give the seller the opportunity to look at the threes and see if they could provide additional information or point out a compensating factor, let's say, to show the Clayton lead that this is not a three, it's a two or it's a one.
Well, in point of fact, Clayton did have a 2T, which was to give somebody the opportunity to bring in documents that were missing from the file. So that wouldn't have counted as in the two W's that they were pushing out. If you'll look at the bottom here, exception level waivers, it says by far the most common waiver exception was, quote, loan characteristics do not match any available program, with 681 waivers representing 11% of all waived exceptions. Do you know what that loan characteristics do not match any available program might have been?
I don't. But what I would say is what it could be is what would come to mind would be an example like I just gave. The loan-to-value ratio mm-hmm. is outside of the parameters, and it became an acceptable risk to whomever was evaluating it.
The next one is actually the one that I'm concerned about. The most common waived exception in 2007 reviews was, quote, stated income not reasonable. How is it that you came? Those waivers were effective. What compensating factors were there that would make income that appeared not reasonable to become reasonable, or other compensating factors? And you may not know the answer to that. This is not a cross-examination. I really don't know the answer to it. I'm just trying to get the data.
Yeah, understood. And I think that in the case of stated income not reasonable, and in fact, I think in the case of all the exceptions, it's very much facts and circumstances of the individual files. So, for example,
yes.
It could be a couple of things. One thing could be that, let's say, for example, the stated income resulted in a debt-to-income ratio of 25%. And Clayton says, that stated income is not reasonable. But an income that was reasonable resulted in a debt-to-income ratio of 40%, which was still within the acceptable debt-to-income guidelines. That could be a reason that you would waive the Clayton finding. Again, just an example
sure. As
a possibility. Not saying that that's what happened.
And again,
possibility.
The two people who would have been making those decisions are John and Patty.
Patty, correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. I think the other possibility that something might get waived is a difference of opinion between the Clayton reviewer as to the reasonableness of stated income and John or Patty. That's another possibility.
And those concerns would have been transmitted to John or Patty on a daily basis from the Clayton due diligence site?
You know, I think it varied. I think, very frankly, Patty was more of a daily keep up with it, and John kind of looked at stuff at the end. But okay. I think it varied from transaction to transaction.
Was this essentially the same process, albeit with different underwriting standards that were employed in other loan origination or acquisition of loans by Bear Stearns, for example, the 1 to 4 families?
For bulk purchases,
yeah.
Yes, this was typically the way it went, and as a very general matter.
But you feel quite certain that Bear, with respect to subprime, did a due diligence review on 100% of its loans?
When we were the purchaser, when EMC
yes.
was the purchaser, yes. There may have been a situation where we did less, and that, again, would have been transaction-specific, but my recollection is that we typically did 100% on the loans we purchased from third parties.
Well, that's a mystery to me. All right.
I just have a question about the due diligence on the who developed the policies for the due diligence area?
The policy for the due diligence area was developed by John and Patty and Baron and myself, along with in-house counsel at the time.
I'm just showing you what would probably mark as Exhibit 4. If you read the first paragraph here, it says, critical, lead, and that presumably means the lead person at Clayton, to call Bear due diligence manager on first morning of job, leave message, leave callback number and or cell number. If you're not aware which contact you should call, contact Greg Quinlan or somebody. This is mandatory. So it looks like, with respect to the due diligence performed by Clayton, that they were under instructions at the commencement of the due diligence process to be in touch with people at Bayer.
Makes sense, yes.
If you'll see, the first bullet point says, please send in the data every night so that we may run the daily reports early the next morning. What is a daily report? Do you know?
That would have been internal to Clayton, I believe.
You don't know whether those daily reports were provided to Bayer?
I don't. You know, a certain element of what has to occur here is just managing the nuts and bolts of getting through the work.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping the transaction or the work done on schedule. So that may have been what that was about.
If you look at the third bullet point here, it indicates that the bid stiffs override all guidelines and must be followed closely. And that you've spoken about what bid stiffs were earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We'll come back to that document in a little bit. I think we're on what, exhibit six?
Five.
This is not a document created by Bayer, it's a document created by Clayton, but it shows that in 2005, with respect to revenue, Bayer was pretty high up on the list. As a matter of fact, was second, only behind Morgan Stanley. But in 2006 and 2007, in terms of the revenue generated, that is, presumably revenue provided to Clayton, it fell behind just a little bit. So that if you look at loan volumes on the line below it, Ferris was doing, in 2005, 132,000. In 2006, 61,000. And in 2007, 24,000. Does that seem to be about right to you?
As I sit here right now, I don't know. It certainly seems plausible. And again, these would be the loan volumes that Clayton reviewed?
Yes, yeah. Clayton reviewed. That
mm-hmm.
is correct.
Yep.
I mean, these are all built off of the Clayton data.
So not necessarily the volume of loans that Bear Stearns or EMC bought or securitized. These would be the ones that Clayton reviewed across all product types.
Yes, that mm-hmm. that is correct. Now,
okay.
Were there loans reviewed by Clayton, to your knowledge, that were not subsequently securitized and or purchased by Bayer?
If Clayton reviewed loans in a bulk purchase and Bayer rejected them and didn't buy them, yes.
Didn't buy the whole pool or loans within the pool.
Or didn't buy the rejects within the pool. There may have been instances where Bayer didn't buy the pool at all. And there would also be instances where Clayton may have been used to do an underwriter's due diligence sample where we didn't buy the loans, but they reviewed loans that were in deals that Bayer was just the underwriter for.
I understand.
So that could be part of these, should be part of these
numbers,
too.
In those instances, how many of the loans, what percentage of the loans would have been subjected to due diligence?
I think it varied by the product type of the third-party issuer. But a typical rule of thumb would have been 10% of
10%.
The pool. Typical.
But with respect to those loans that Bayer purchased, brought in its own inventory, and subsequently packaged and securitized under its own or a variety of names, it did 100% of the due diligence on those, you think?
For subprime.
Okay. We'll take a little break.
Sure.
And then we'll pick up here in a couple of minutes,
sure.
If that's all right.
Sounds
thank
good.
You.
Do you have a sense overall, Tom?
All right. I've got 12:13. We're back on record.
Do you have any notion as to what time that Bear Stearns ceased its operations in connection with performing due diligence for Bear Res? And I'll tell you why I'm asking the question. I'm trying to determine whether or not the 72,000 loans are involved in the figures we have here from Clayton. Would it have been before the first quarter of 2006, before Bear Res was up and operational and was putting its doing its own internal due diligence?
I think that's possible, yes, because they started making loans in April or May of 2005.
Okay.
So that sounds about right. Again, without certainty, but it sounds reasonable.
What other methodologies, the purchase of bulk loans, the Bear Res generating loan,
mm-hmm.
what other methodologies, if any, did Bear Stearns employ for the acquisition of loans, mortgage loans, for its securitization desk?
Bear Stearns had, or EMC had a channel that we called the flow conduit.
Oh,
and that was an operation that was located in Lewisville, Texas, within the EMC servicing operation. And that operation reported up to the head of EMC servicing.
Well, describe to me the flow conduit.
Flow conduit was a situation where an originator would be approved to sell loans to the flow conduit. And once approved to sell, that originator would get a daily pricing sheet. Every day for a certain period of time, call it 9 to 4 or something like that, the originator could then sell loans to EMC by calling up the commitment desk and registering the loans at a price for delivery in 30 days or 45 days or 60 days out.
So let me stop you for Tom, are you still here?
Yes.
All right, sorry, I apologize.
So unlike bulk, with bulk, the originator offered their package of loans out to a number of investors, and Bear Stearns or EMC could choose to bid them or not bid them.
Yes.
But for flow, as long as that originator was approved and in good standing, they could sell, trade, all day long based on the prices that were outlined on the rate sheet, sheet.
In addition to the pricing sheet, were these people who could sell loans to the conduit, the flow conduit, were they also provided with a minimum standards or due diligence or underwriting standards?
Yes. Each flow seller entered into a mortgage loan purchase agreement. That mortgage loan purchase agreement over time changed to reference a seller guide. The seller guide contained information about how to register, how to deliver loans, in general what the process for reviewing loans would be at EMC's operation, in general how the settlement process would work, and it included underwriting guidelines. The sellers also had the option to submit their own underwriting guidelines for approval. And this is what I described earlier, where staff at the EMC flow conduit would review that seller's own guidelines against EMC's and approve the seller's guidelines with certain restrictions.
But the due diligence was performed at the flow conduit level?
Yes, it was performed by employees of EMC. That's correct.
Were those loans or any other loans, whether acquired through the flow conduit or through the bulk loan purchases, were they ever re-underwritten? Was there another procedure that they had to go through, or was this the procedure, the due diligence side of the procedure?
The due diligence review was the procedure that we went through in order to buy the loans, yes. In addition to that, there was a quality control review that was done on a sample of the loans, and that was done after the loans were purchased by EMC.
Again, that was an in-house review?
Yes, although an outsourcer was used to perform some of it, and the name of that company was Advitec. A-D-V as in Victor, I-T-E-C-K, C-H, I believe.
So we have loans purchased in bulk, loans generated by Bear Res and the flow conduit. Were there any other methodologies employed at Bear Stearns for the acquisition of mortgages that were ultimately to be securitized?
In 2007, February of 2007, Bear Res completed its acquisition of certain of the assets of Encore Credit.
Not really good timing, was it? I'm sorry that... Everybody in the room knows that now, I'm sure. And that was February of 2007?
Correct.
Were those loans, did they appear in, how were the loans generated by Encore Credit evaluated for purposes of meeting the guidelines? Were they subjected to due diligence as well?
Prior to the settlement of the asset purchase, they were subjected to due diligence, yes. And after that, I don't recall exactly what we did.
Going back to the flow conduit and the acknowledgement and the underwriting guidelines contained in the seller guide, were there also warranties and representations regarding having complied with the underwriting guidelines by those persons who were providing loans pursuant to the flow conduit?
The mortgage loan purchase agreement had many, many reps and warranties. And to the best of my recollection, there was one that said the loans are underwritten in accordance with the agreed upon guidelines.
Was due diligence undertaken to determine whether to put back those loans or some of those loans?
The quality control review that I spoke about that occurs post-closing, if the quality control review showed a breach of the representation and warranty, and that breach had a material and adverse effect on the loan, then the loan was to be put back to the originator. That was the standard in the mortgage loan purchase agreement. The breach had to have a material and adverse effect on the loan.
Was that term also employed in connection with the bulk purchases, material and adverse effect?
Mm-hmm.
Did Bear Stearns utilize any warehouse lending for the acquisition of a mortgage loan?
Bear Stearns had two warehouse facilities. One was operated under a company called Bear Stearns Mortgage Capital Corporation, and the other was operated under a company called EMC Residential Mortgage Corporation. The Bear Stearns Mortgage Capital Corporation lines were to larger originators, and they were what was commonly referred to as aggregation lines. So, for example, a line may have been extended to People's Choice such that People's Choice could use that line to make loans until they had enough critical mass to do a securitization. That was the general idea for that warehouse business. The one at EMC Residential was about 20 or 25 customers, and those with an aggregate at the largest of about $500 or $600 million in outstandings.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of that line was to make warehouse funds available to smaller sellers who were then going to sell whole loans to end investors. So two different business lines within the firm.
Under either line, were the recipients of the warehouse lending facility obligated to sell their or to offer their loans to Bear Stearns, or were they free to offer them to anybody on the street?
They were free to offer them to anybody on the street.
To the extent that they were offered to Bear Stearns, were they also subjected to the due diligence as we've discussed with respect to bulk purchases?
Yes. Or to the flow conduit due diligence,
yes,
depending on which channel they selected.
explain that to me. How were they given an option as to which channel they could select? I'm just taking a right turn, and I didn't follow you. Tell me.
This would relate to the EMC residential warehouse line.
Uh-huh.
So if I am a seller that has a warehouse line with EMC residential, I may be allowed to sell bulk, and I may also be signed up to sell flow. And the decision for an originator to sell bulk or flow is really based on their own risk appetite to take interest rate risk. So for flow, if I make a commitment to you as a homeowner to sell you, to do a loan for you at 5%, the safest thing for me to do that same exact day is to sell your loan forward to somebody else. So then I'm matched, and I don't have any risk. And that's called a best efforts commitment.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't close with me, I don't have to deliver it out. So for an originator, the safest thing to do is to sell flow. As the market heated up during that time period, some originators chose to bulk up and take some of that interest rate risk to get more proceeds.
I have a question about Encore Credit. Was that which side of the fence did they receive a warehouse line, or did they receive it on both the Bear Stearn and the EMC?
Encore's warehouse line was Bear Stearns Mortgage Capital Corporation.
And do you know how large of a facility that was?
I don't recall, no.
During your tenure at Bear Stearns, were there did it come a point in time when you elected not to deal with a particular loan originator?
Yes.
Who was that?
There were a number of them. People's Choice would have been one.
People's Choice?
Yes. There was a group within the EMC operation that was responsible for monitoring sellers, and they would make the recommendations to stop doing business. So there were quite a few. What would happen first is we may say, or look at the performance and say, and this I recall in 2006, your performance for 100% LTV product is not good. You can't sell us 100% LTV product anymore. That happened with a company called Entrust Mortgage.
Entrust?
E-N-T-R-U-S-T, yeah. And then in early 2007, there were quite a few originators who were, the business relationship was terminated because their capital levels fell below the requirement.
Why would you have capital levels with the loan originators? To ensure that they had the ability to buy them back when you went back to them?
The capital levels weren't that high. They were typically $1 million tangible net worth. But that was part of the reason, yes. I think that it was a delegated underwriting program. So that was a typical industry standard of capital levels for delegated underwriting.
What were some of the other requirements of that program in addition to the capital requirements?
As part of the approval process, when a new seller presented themselves, there was an application that was filled out,
mm-hmm.
which gave the level of experience of the principals and the chief officers. One of the other requirements was that the originator be a HUD-approved mortgagee. Typically, the originators would have experience with mortgage insurance, although not always, because certainly in subprime, there was no mortgage insurance. The originators had to have a warehouse line. They had to be mortgage bankers. And I believe that we typically looked for some sort of track record, either in the current company or with the principals in prior companies. In addition, references would be called, which would be typically other investors, the warehouse banks.
By other investment, meaning other investment banks?
Yes.
People who had done business with them purchasing their product.
Correct.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay.
Well, I did mean to interrupt you, but that's...
And mortgage insurance companies.
Okay.
Quality control policies would be submitted and reviewed. The underwriting guidelines would be submitted and reviewed. And typically that approval group would hold a conference call with the operational people to just discuss how loans are originated, closed, and funded, and then just talk about logistical items with respect to delivery of the files and then the transfer of servicing from the originator to EMC in connection with the purchase.
When Clayton departed Bear Res, we think sometime in maybe 2005, probably before the first quarter of 2006, how many personnel did you have devoted to underwriting in that operation, do you know?
At Bear Res, I don't recall.
Yeah. What about at your flow lines? How many folks did you have there dedicated to underwriting and due diligence?
I don't remember exactly, but order of magnitude for that whole operation, which would include flow underwriters, maybe like 8 people on the commitment desk, and then people that would do funding reviews, order of magnitude around 120 people.
How many of the...
I'm sorry, that's for all the products, just subprime, all the products.
Tell us the types of product other than subprime that you engaged in the purchase of mortgages.
In the flow conduit, there was very little subprime that came through the flow conduit, so it was chiefly the Alt-A product, adjustable rate and fixed rate Alt-A products.
I'm going to ask you a question that has been dogging me since I started this project. What's the difference? How do you know the difference between when does Alt-A become subprime?
I think that in your travels, you'll probably get a lot of different nuances and answers.
Believe me, I am.
So I'll tell you what it meant to me and what it meant to us at Bear. A couple of things. Some of the big picture ones were, first of all, subprime would be loan-to-value ratios over 80% with no mortgage insurance. That's a very large differentiator. If it was an Alt-A loan and the loan-to-value ratio was over 80%, you required mortgage insurance in most cases. The second thing that differentiated subprime was the originator. And by that I mean that when the originator went to the marketplace to originate the loans, they marketed a subprime program. So if the originator was a retail originator that employed loan officers to talk to homeowners, or they were a wholesaler that employed account executives to go call on brokers, they were marketing a subprime product. Another major differentiator between subprime and Alt-A was just how the rate sheet is constructed. Alt-A rate sheet starts with a base interest rate with a price associated with it. And then you have a lot of different attributes that impact that base rate, like is it a second home or an investment property or primary residence. Each of those, after primary being the base rate, but if it's a second or investor, you might change the price, which in turn affects the interest rate. So Alt-A was characterized by a lot of these risk-based pricing, is what we call it, all these different attributes. Typically, and this did change over time, but the combined loan-to-value ratio, you didn't see first and seconds in subprime as prevalently as you saw in Alt-A. It was unusual to see a first and second piggyback in subprime. Subprime was very much that on the adjustable rate side, that 228 and 327 product, you didn't see that in Alt-A. For Alt-A, the arms would be a 3-6 LIBOR, a 5-6 LIBOR, 7 and 10. Typically, the loan amounts, just on average, tended to be smaller with subprime. But again, the big differentiator for me would be the originator was offering a subprime product.
And what he called it, you call it.
Well, it had these other attributes.
Sure.
And you know, it was very much a way of how the loans were priced and marketed. Again, you know, this notion of the all the price adjustments on all day, which you didn't have that same kind of granularity in subprime.
So you acquire a company in February of 2007. How long had it been operating prior to the acquisition?
I'm not 100% sure, but I believe it was several years. I want to say 04-ish. Could have been before that, could have been after that.
So you've got a pipeline of mortgages ready to be securitized, and then all of a sudden the market disappears. What happens to those mortgages that could not be securitized?
Mortgages that can't be securitized remain with the owner of them.
Do you have a notion as to how many of those were on Bear Stearns' books, say, September of 07?
I don't, as I sit here today.
Was there a point in time where you saw the market turn, where you knew there was no longer a market in the securitization for RMBS, mortgage-backed securities?
I think that the team at Bear Stearns, yes, saw that. I mean, the team at Bear Stearns was talking to and the investor base daily and certainly saw that.
When was that?
Sometime throughout 2007. I can't tell you with
Before
specificity.
BSAM crashed on 7/31 of 07?
There was a lot of activity in the market, or I don't know if volatility is the right word, but there was a lot happening in March, April, May, in general, in the all-day markets. So as I sit here today, exactly what happened when, I can't tell you.
Do you have a knowledge of how much or how often Bear Stearns was going to the market with RMBS or mortgage-backed securities during that time frame? Had it resulted in a trickle of offerings, or was there a number of them attempted to get ready to move? What happened during that period of time when there was all this volatility in the market with respect to securitizations?
I don't want to answer because I don't remember exactly. I'm sorry.
Is it fair to say that there came a point in time in 2007 when you realized this deal is over?
When certainly the volume started to come down and there was less demand. Yes, that occurred during that springtime into the summer. Yes.
With respect to that springtime and summer, what did you do, you and with the loans that had been or were then being originated at Bear Res and your new acquired company and your flow channels? What were you doing with those?
One thing that we were doing during that time period is reducing the number that we bought. And during that time period, we were also reducing the types of loans that we bought, meaning I believe sometime during those time periods, we stopped buying the no-income verification loans and the no-ratio loans. At some point during that time period, we stopped buying the negative amortization loans. Again, I can't tell you exactly what products when. But there was a lot of activity with respect to reducing the variety of the offering.
You just used a term that I'm not familiar with. Maybe my colleagues are. No ratio loans. What does that mean?
No ratio is a documentation type description, like full doc or stated income or no documentation. And you would typically, in a no ratio verified asset, verify liquid assets, but you would not only not verify income, you would not require the borrower to state the income. And because they're not stating the income, you can't calculate a debt-to-income ratio. So hence the name.
When did those loans come into being?
I don't remember exactly when. Somewhere
presumably
in that time period, the 03 to 07 time period, somewhere along that line.
Um, did there come a point in time at Bear Stearns where, following the volatility in the market, following the fact that we want to cut back on our purchases, that we began to intensify our efforts to put loans back to originators?
There was a group at EMC whose job it was to put loans back to originators. Loans went back to originators for two reasons. The first reason was in the mortgage loan purchase agreement between EMC and the sellers, there was typically the sellers made a covenant that if one of the first, second, or third payments due to EMC after the loan was sold to EMC became delinquent, EMC had the right to put that loan back to the originator. Sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. A reason that they wouldn't would typically be if the delinquency was caused by some sort of servicing transfer confusion on the part of the borrower that then righted itself. So the borrower sent the payment to the old mortgage company. They should have sent it to EMC. The old mortgage company forwards it to EMC. It gets there late. It shows as a delinquency. Those types of things EMC would typically not put back to the originator.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was a true default, EMC would seek to do that. The second reason that EMC would put a loan back to an originator is if they had done a quality control review and found a breach of a rep and warranty that materially and adversely impacted the loan. And that would be a basis for putting the loan back.
What were the common breaches of reps and warranties that were experienced during this period of time?
Let's see. I think what one would typically see would be things like the appraised value of the property was misstated. It could be that the borrower represented that they were going to be the primary residence, and it was in fact an investor property was discovered. Another thing that occurred over time was that the borrowers would not disclose all their debts. So what we would see from time to time was a borrower might buy five properties on the same day, get them financed by five different lenders, and not tell each other that they had all this indebtedness. So those would be the type of things that you could discover later.
Presumably you're not buying all five of those loans.
Correct. You're not.
You're buying just the one, and then you discover the existence of the other four.
Yeah.
Who was doing the due diligence in connection with these putbacks at that time?
The quality control group at EMC. And as I said earlier, some of those reviews were done by employees of EMC, and some of the reviews were outsourced to Advitech. And there may have been other outsourced companies, but Advitech was the major one.
When it came to offering RMBS, mortgage-backed securities, would all of these methods that you have described of acquiring loans, would they funnel those loans into the package of loans that were to be securitized?
Typically, yes.
So we could, you couldn't count on just one methodology unless that was, well, How can you distinguish, based on any records that we have shown you, whether or not Bear was just a underwriter, a pure underwriter, and not a seller as well as an underwriter? I don't suppose that there is a method that we could go back in and determine which one of the underwritings done, of the due diligence done by Clayton and other due diligence firms was done in connection with the underwriting for another seller.
Well, presumably Clayton should have that data because when they were engaged, they should presumably know that. You know, whether or not they kept it at that level or not, I don't know. You know, the other thing that we don't know from the Clayton reports is the product mix. I mean, some of these could be jumbo A products that we bought from Wells Fargo or Countrywide. And we did quite a bit of that in the adjustable rate markets.
It may very well be that we have the ability to go back and find that. I'll get in touch with you in the event that I do. How are these mortgages packaged and securitized? How are they sold to investors?
Bear Stearns and EMC had a number of different shelf names that they used to create the securities. And it was, the shelves were pretty much arranged by general product type. So there might be one shelf that was used to securitize subprime. There would be a shelf or a number of shelf designations used to securitize an offer, adjustable rate jumbo, fixed rate jumbo, adjustable rate all day, fixed rate all day, second liens, home equity lines of credit, scratch and dent product. So there were a number of different shelf designations that were really a way of kind of segregating the different product types to be pooled and securitized.
Were any of them, is it your understanding that they were all sold in registered offerings as opposed to 144A offerings?
There may have been 144A from time to time, but I believe primarily they were SEC shelf registrations.
Now, did you have anything to do with meeting with and consulting with the rating agencies in connection with these offerings?
Earlier in my career, I did. In the 2002 and forward time frame, my meetings with the rating agencies would have been extremely limited and much more on the kind of platform level description of how we acquired the loans, not on specific pool rating agency levels.
What interface did you have with the Bear Stearns trading desk, if any?
Well, Jeff Fershleiser was a senior trader on the trading desk, and I spoke to Jeff quite a bit. If you think in terms of the desk, there were traders that were responsible for pricing to buy the assets, mm-hmm. and then there were traders responsible for pricing the new issues to sell the securities, and there were traders that specialized in the AAA tranches and traders that specialized in the credit tranches and structure people. So it was quite a large number of people. So the folks that I would interface with were chiefly the traders responsible for pricing the acquisition.
Credit tranches, what were they?
In its simplest format, what we would call a senior subordinate shifting interest structure, a pool of 1-4 family residential mortgage loans would go into a trust, and then tranches would be created that were rated AAA, AA, single A, triple B, double B, single B, and unrated. So those were referred to as credit tranches, meaning that the credit designation the rating agency ascribed to it.
What would you do, if you know, you may not, with those tranches for which you could not find a purchaser in connection with the registered offerings? What happened to those?
If a purchaser wasn't found, I believe the broker-dealer kept it in inventory. They may have been on EMC's balance sheet or the broker-dealer. I'm not sure.
Were they, some of them, subsequently sold to triple B tranches to CDO offerings?
They may have been. I don't know.
What is your knowledge or what is your belief that what happened to the equity tranche or the residual tranches?
I don't know with specificity. They would either be held or sold.
With respect to those that were sold, have you any notion as to who were the likely purchasers?
I don't.
Are you aware of any aggregation of the equity tranches of building up of a base of non-saleable equity tranches during any time?
Not with any specificity.
how often did you meet with your folks who are responsible for coordinating with your third-party due diligence providers in connection with making a determination as to whether to accept or reject a classification of loans that had been rated as threes? I hope you understand that question.
I do. I would say from time to time, but not very often. Much more so earlier in the life of this operation that we've been describing, so 02, 03. But then as the business grew, much less so.
Did there come a time as the business was developing that your colleagues and you became concerned about the quality of the loans that you were seeing?
Yes.
Were those? Did you see an increase in early default payments?
We saw an increase in the volume in general, and with that came an increase in the number of early default payments. Part of the quality control review that was done that I described, and then some of the reasons that things were put back, is things that we learned. And so in response to learning those things, we tried to implement procedures before we bought the loans to detect those types of problems and avoid them. So one of the things that we did is we did a newsletter to all our sellers to point out some of these things that we had seen, like misrepresentation of occupancy, like the undisclosed debts, because the originator is obviously much closer to the situation,
yeah,
and should undertake procedures to prevent these types of things from happening.
I would sorely like to see some of those letters. It'd be helpful for me for the purpose of giving a picture, and I hope you understand what we're doing here. We're trying to give a picture of this market as it develops, and we're trying to superimpose that picture that we get, and the more we talk with folks, the better able we are to do that and to give a picture of this is where things begin to get in the ditch. And your awareness of folks like yourself and your staff will help us do that. If you can find some of those newsletters, it would be very helpful to us. Mm-hmm. I would appreciate it. Do you know where they are like? Well, of course you do, but this has been years ago, so you have no idea where they are. You didn't retain any, did you?
If they were created on the firm's books and records, they either made it over to J.P. Morgan or they didn't, right? Yeah. They're maybe in some folder someplace.
You've said that there came a time that you began to see this. Can you tell us the approximate time that you began to see it? And it may have been gradual, but what period of time would this have been when you began to notice these changes?
I don't recall specifically, but I would say certainly in the 2006 time frame. Exactly when, I can't tell you sitting here today. May have been before.
Do you have any? Oh, yeah, I've got more documents I haven't even touched here. So. Another?
Sure.
You may or may not be familiar with this, but this is information that's been provided to us by Clayton, having to do with the types of information that are provided by the seller of loan pools to firms like Bear Stearns for purposes of evaluation of or preparatory to due diligence on a pool of loans. The data tape, you did receive those in connection with the bids?
Yes.
And did you provide them to the due diligence firm or did the seller direct?
I'm not exactly sure, but I believe what was typical is that we would have provided it to the due diligence firm.
The underwriting guidelines, that was part of the invitation to bid as well?
Yes, we would have to give Clayton a set of guidelines to review against, yes.
And those guidelines that you would have given them would have been the guidelines profess to be in place by the loan originator.
Correct.
And you would, and is it your belief that you provided them, or the seller or the loan pool originator provided them?
With respect to the underwriting guidelines, I don't know. I think it could have been either. I would think it would have been more typical for them to come from us, because we're hiring Clayton to do this review, so we would want to be in control of the data.
Mm-hmm.
But it very well could be that the seller provided them when Clayton showed up to do the diligence.
Obviously, the correspondence would be between you and the client and Clayton. And the correspondence related to day-to-day review, that would have been provided by Clayton to you. The final item here is correspondence related to deal review tie-out. What is a deal review tie-out?
Again, hard to know exactly what they mean here, but based on my experience, what I would believe this to mean is trailing documentation required to clear exceptions. So as I said before, when Clayton has their findings, they would typically communicate that to the due diligence manager, but also to the seller. So the seller has the opportunity to find missing documentation or to answer questions or to, if you will, cure what Clayton thinks is a deficiency. Right. So the final tie-out should be the aggregation of all that data and agreeing at the and finalizing the due diligence so that there's an agreement at the end of the engagement. These are the ones, these are the twos, these are the threes, we're closed.
Who is that meet? Is that a meeting, a telephonic conference?
I think it's a telephonic conference, or it's highly plausible it would just be email exchanges as well. And that should be the seller, Clayton, and the due diligence manager that participates.
So all three of you would be involved in that?
That's typically how it should have worked.
And this is to conclude the due diligence research and tie up any loose questions that might be circulating out there about the due conduct of the due diligence.
Correct.
I'm not entirely certain of what I'm looking at here, but it appears to be a Bear Stearns final report set. This mm-hmm. presumably is something that you received at the conclusion of the due diligence review by Clayton and or any other due diligence firm. Is that right?
This looks like the type of data that would be transmitted, yes. Data upload, due diligence issues upload, IAS on event one, must be individual asset summary.
All right.
Right, so that would be the individual.
That's the third item here, IAS
yeah.
on event one loans. All right.
And then the same for event two and three. Loan disposition. Not sure. And production report, I'm not sure what they mean by that.
Would this report also have been prepared and delivered to Moody's and S&P? These reports?
You know, I don't know. I don't think typically they would have been. And then somewhere along the line they may have asked for them. But I don't know. This reference you see to S&P/Moody's fields included in the report, you
mm-hmm.
see S&P income documentation type field.
Right.
S&P had very specific definitions for the documentation type. So I believe that's what this is talking about.
In anticipation of a submission to S&P, we wanted to make certain that the documentation was in the form identifiable or that S&P was used to send.
Right.
Tom, do you have any idea of the date of this document?
I do not, which is part of the problem. And I apologize for that, but I'm dealing with what I've got.
Oh, look at this. Now, this is interesting. Look at the footnote here.
Grade used in data upload?
Bear Stearns System does not accept alpha grade designations. That's why I never heard of a 2W.
Okay.
Right? Map it to an event 4 for Bear Stearns. And what event four was?
Yes.
Is the something that was a three that the due diligence manager looked at and said, with either additional information from the client or I disagree with your finding, it's acceptable to us.
So we cleared that mystery.
Yes.
So a 2W is an event four.
Yes.
And his decision was made on event fours by the Bear Stearns due diligence manager.
Correct.
So that when we looked at exhibit, I think it's two, this one.
The blue?
The blue, the all Clayton reject and waiver. If I look at the final waiver rate, and I'm assuming that that's of the 11,000 rejected loans, 42% of those were waived in by someone at Bear Stearns?
Help me read this.
Okay.
So we have 60,000.
Reading from left to right, event ones.
60,000. Okay.
Yeah, and then
6,800 rejections.
Rejections.
4,900 WNT. And so you believe that these are the fours?
That's right.
All right, so which we would need to confirm, obviously, but. So 4,900 fours out of 7,200 reviewed.
Correct.
So that's like 5% or a little more than that.
But what I'm a little concerned about is if I go all the way to the right to final waiver, it says total initial Clayton rejects, 11,000. That must have been...
Total init... So is that 6,848 plus 4,923? 3 and 8 is 11, 2, 7... Yeah, that looks like the EV3s plus the WNT columns added together.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right? All right? So initially, that's the total there, and then 68 stayed as 3s, and 49 turned to 4s, it looks like. So 42% is 49 out of the 11, looks like.
That would appear to be
okay.
So, yes.
Okay. Yeah, and there are lots of reasons that something goes from a 3 to a 4. And again, you're not seeing if this is just credit or it's also compliance. One of the things that would typically happen in California is because the way the loans are closed and get from the closing table with the borrower to the mortgage company, and then they would sell them very quickly, you didn't always have the final HUD 1. Without the final HUD 1, you can't do the compliance testing. So if you can't do the compliance testing, you get an event level 3 for compliance, and then maybe a week or two later it comes in and it's fine and you can convert it to a 4. I'm not saying that's what this is.
No, no,
but
it's entirely
it's
possible. Because,
yeah.
I mean, there was a 2W, and there was also, as I understand it, a 2T.
What's the 2T?
That's precisely the document you described.
Oh, the HUD 1?
Deleting documents.
Trailing. Oh, T for trailing.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what would appear. Now, assuming that there is a potential number of the final waiver rates of 42%, of course, we have no way of knowing which one of those are T's and which one are two are fours under your volumes.
Right.
To your knowledge, did Bear Stearns maintain any records that related to decisions to turn event three loans or event three loans into fours under Bear Stearns?
Oh, boy. If they...
Well, we would call two W's.
Yeah, if they did, it would probably be like in the individual bulk transaction deal file. So in other words, Patty or John may have made a notation to the file. I don't know where it was captured, and that may have changed over time. But as I sit here today, I can't tell you where to go look for that.
You know where Patty or John are now?
I sure do.
Where?
Patty Sears is sitting in Louisville, Texas. She still works for J.P. Morgan.
Wow.
And John Mongaluzzo works at GMAC in Philadelphia. Or
well,
Fort Washington, whatever it's called.
That's a surprise, isn't it? It seems to be a home for folks from Bear Stearns. You have any questions, Tom? Yo, Tom.
Yes, I have some questions about on the performance of the flow versus the bulk. Was there any studies ever done at Bear Stearns or EMC about the comparing the two?
I believe that there were from time to time, and I don't recall the results.
Also, was your group, according to the industry, Bear Stearns was an expert in the field and presented many studies or newsletters on the performance of not of the entire market, individual deals, and so on. Did you ever see the performance of your individual deals going back to you as far as the default rates?
I recall in early 2007 being shown some of that data. Prior to that, no. And in the acquisition operation, the focus was on the entire platform as opposed to individual deals. So the work that the research group did to look at performance was in connection with trading and security trading. And performance at the individual deal level didn't come back to the origination operation. Except, as I said, in early 2007, there was some data that was presented.
Now the quality control group, would they be reviewing each of the sellers of originators of these loans on an originator basis?
The quality control group looked at individual mortgage loans, and it was the general practice that they would look at the first 25 maybe or 50 loans submitted by a new originator. And again, I think that was as a general matter what the practice was.
Well, as far as the looking at the entire pool, did they review all the repurchases, or they were responsible for all the repurchases for every issue?
And when you say issue, you're referring to the deals, the securitizations out? The quality control people didn't know what loans were in which deals. They looked at the assets at the originator level or the product level.
So the you all did not follow the performance of the specific originators until 2007, at least for your group.
No, the originator, when you say follow the performance of an originator, there was a monitoring group at EMC that looked at performance at the originator level, which was separate and apart from the Bear Stearns research group that looked at performance of individual deals.
Right. And did they share that information with you?
Which, the monitoring group at EMC?
Exactly.
Yeah, that was the basis for making decisions about changes to the due diligence protocols as we learned things about breaches of reps and warranties, as I discussed about the newsletter. That was the basis for making decisions to curtail certain products that certain originators could sell. And that was basis for making decisions about ceasing doing business with certain originators.
And how long was this group in existence?
The quality control group that did the loan level reviews was in existence from the beginning of the flow conduit. And then the monitoring group, and so was the seller approval. And out of those two groups is what the monitoring grew into. And I would say that the monitoring really started to step up and take more formal shape in the beginning of 2005.
But they would also do the bulk, right? It would not just the flow.
The quality control on the bulk, yes, that's true, with the exception of large originators of jumbo product. And so specifically I'm thinking of Wells Fargo and Countrywide. The view was that we didn't need to do the same level of quality control or frankly that quality control review on those originators because of the track record that they had, because of the financial stability that they had, and the large volumes that they did of jumbo product. And also because such large pools were purchased and then securitized, there was disclosure about who they were, and the market understood who those originators were.
So just to get some more clarity on that, so they would follow the originator, so for a Fieldstone or a Fremont, or they would look at it on a deal basis too, right?
The seller monitoring group at EMC did not look at originators on a deal basis. They looked at the originator's production across everything that they sold.
So for Fieldstone, for example, if there was a number of early payment defaults, that group would see that there was 100 early payment defaults, you know, this week or whatever, which might cause an alarm, be much higher than all the other originators. Is that something that would have been earmarked for your review and others at EMC?
Yes, there was a ranking of the originators. Yes, that's right.
So you would see how these collectively all the deals for a Fieldstone or those that have Fieldstone product in it, you would see how many repurchases, how many early payment defaults, how many other defaults for these particular loans, right?
I'm just troubled by your use of the word deals, because the folks at EMC they had no idea where the loans were. They could have been sold to an individual investor. They could have been in 100 deals or in one deal. They didn't see it at the deal level.
Yeah, and all I'm saying here is that for a Fieldstone, let's say, for example, if you saw 100 early payment defaults, that could represent many different deals, but it could give an alarm that it was 20% higher than most of the other originators under the bulk or the full program.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. On the policy side. Was there an occasion in the policies, was it dictated that if the exception rate was very high, that the John or Patty would have to present those findings to you?
I'm going to parse the question a little bit, because when we talk about exception rates, we're typically talking about situations where we're doing a sample due diligence. Because when you do 100% due diligence, you're by definition not buying the ones that you're rejecting, so you feel fine about the pool that you have. So exception rates tended to come into play when we were doing a sample. Typically, if the exception rate or reject rate on a sample exceeded 2 or 3% of the sample, then we would typically expand the sample and look at more assets to follow up on that.
Now, would they when there was an increase in the sample size, would they, Patty and John, alert you to the fact that this pool is developing higher than, you know, than the normal exception rate?
They might have. I mean, I think that would depend on how big the pool was. You know, if it was a really small pool, we typically looked at all of the assets anyway. I mean, what's the point of doing a sample on a 20-loan pool? Just look at all of them. So they may have alerted me, or they may have alerted Barron.
Okay. And on 100% on the subprime side, if there were problems, by problems meaning that there was the credit issues were under the underwriting guidelines were not being met with 10, 20, 30% of the entire universe of loans, would they bring that to your attention too?
Yes.
Okay. And did that happen often?
No, but it did happen from time to time. And if you have an exception rate, or if you have a kick-out rate that high, you know, the seller is not very happy with you. And so you have a discussion, and I would say generally you agree to disagree, and the seller goes and sells it to somebody else.
Who were the biggest sellers, originators who had the, you know, the large kickout rate?
The one that comes to mind on subprime was Quick Loan Funding.
And would you typically just refuse to bid on the on this pool, or would you possibly offer them a discounted spread on it?
Well, there's two different, or a couple ways to go about it. One would be to just be clearer in your upfront steps about the types of loans you won't take, so that when you bid them, there's no, you know, Quick Loan Funding understands that these are your guidelines, you're not going to take loans that don't meet them. So you can be clearer about what those things that cause you to kick them out on the last trade were, and tell them up front you're not taking them, and they can decide to sell you or not sell you the pool. With respect to discounting, that was typically not done, with the exception of the fact that EMC had a separate line of business that bought scratch and dent loans. Scratch and dent loans are, by definition, have some sort of defect, and they're priced accordingly. So as kind of like a full service to the seller, the EMC scratch and dent desk would oftentimes bid the loans that the regular secondary market conduit rejected. And the scratch and dent desk would typically bid at a discount. And those loans were separate and kept in a separate business line and securitized separately or held in portfolio.
On Bear's turn. Okay.
And EMC, yes.
That's all the questions I have right now.
Got a couple. For those, in those instances where Bear Stearns was purely an underwriter, was not the seller, how is it that 10% sampling came to be the norm?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer as a general fact. I can give you my impression.
Please.
Which is that it just developed over time from the late 80s all the way through the 2000s as a reasonable random representation of the pool. And underwriters have an underwriter's liability, and they discharge some of that liability by doing some due diligence. And I think that it was always our advice of in-house counsel that 10% seems like an industry standard that can get you there. That's my best explanation. It's by no means expert or factual.
What is your reaction to this, then?
What's that?
What's your reaction to this, then? If you hire me to sell your pool, I only look at 10%. But if I'm selling it, I'm going to go look at 100% of the loans. Now, I'm still the same underwriter, still have the same obligation. How is it that we have two different standards here?
Well, I think you have to think about the size of the originator that can do a securitization. You know, when we talk about 100% of the loans, it's mostly for smaller originators that don't have the wherewithal to aggregate. And Bear Stearns did not do a lot of transactions with the big ones. We did a couple of Fremont transactions where we did 100% due diligence, and I think we maybe did a New Century transaction where we bought and did 100%. So from the question that you're asking me, I think that the market, or I'll back up and say it a different way, an issuer that comes to market month in and month out develops a track record. And it's important to them and their ability to continue to access the capital markets to protect that track record. So they're going to put loans in the deal that perform to expectation, and I believe that's the basis for a 10% sample, as opposed to that same originator that then selects a pool to sell as whole loans. One could think that there's an adverse selection potentially to the loans that they carve out to sell as whole loans, which would also necessitate wanting to do more due diligence. So I think it's really the track record. I think that, again, repeat issuers that come time and time again, you get a chance to see how the loans perform, and it's all part and parcel of the risk assessment.
Who were some of those repeat issuers? Countrywide?
Sure, yes. Countrywide, Wells Fargo, RFC.
RFC, yeah.
Yeah, RFC was residential funding. It was subsequently merged with GMAC and to form ResCap. But RFC was a very big all-day originator before that, one of the earliest prime jumbo conduit companies. Washington Mutual certainly came with their own deals. Bank of America. Chase. How could I forget Chase?
is your position here that WaMu was one of those folks who, because they continually came to the market, were to be considered somehow that only 10% of their loans needed to be reviewed?
I don't know that we did. I don't know what we underwrote for Washington Mutual or not. And, you know, you just asked me how did it come about.
Yeah.
I think that's how it came about. I think there was an industry standard over years and years, really starting with the Jumbo A business for 10%. And, you know, I have no other explanation beside that.
Find it. And I have seldom found as articulate and as an informed witness as you. And you've been very helpful to us. And for that, I very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yield spread premium. On stuff you originate, did BMC, Bear Stearns, pay a yield spread premium to a broker for, say, an ARM as opposed to a fixed rate?
Do me a favor and define it, just because people use that term.
Sure. A higher percentage or a higher payoff for a broker for, say, an ARM over a fixed rate, or for a higher rate over a lower rate for
yes,
a farming.
Yes, that occurred, yes.
Okay. Could you give me, you've talked about some of the different shelves you have and different originate and purchase. Could you give me just maybe percentages on how much you might purchase of your portfolio or of your what you securitize, how much comes in from purchase rather than originate? Just like an idea of the universe.
Yeah, that's going to be very tough to say because we had huge swings in
change
some
over
of
time.
Yeah, in some like a Countrywide could come with $1 billion. Which just changes the percentages really dramatically. But I think that I remember, and this may be in some of the things that, say, like a Warren Spector reported, that the percentage of what we did that we originated ourselves or through the flow conduit was something like 10%. order of magnitude. I don't know that it got much higher than that, maybe 20.
Some of this stuff I think you might have answered in bits and pieces. I'm just going to ask for clarification. When J.P. Morgan took over, there were apparently a large amount of seasoned loans in portfolio. Are you familiar with that?
Not with specificity, but it would make sense to me that there was, yes.
Why would those seasoned loans have been held in portfolio, your best?
Well, I think for the reason that we discussed before is that the securitization markets ended.
Okay. So they just got caught in the pipeline?
Yes.
Okay.
There may have also been seasoned loans that were acquired when warehouse lines had to be foreclosed upon. So we talked about Bear Stearns Mortgage Capital Corporation extending a warehouse line of credit to, say, American Home or Home Bank, who were mortgage loan originators. And if they went out of business, they weren't able to sell those loans and satisfy the warehouse line, so they may have been foreclosed off the warehouse line. And that would have been another source of whole loan inventory.
I thought I heard you answer this. I'm not 100% sure. The use of third-party due diligence firms,
mm-hmm.
was that more from a perspective of price negotiating, or was that more from a perspective of to ensure the quality of the underlying asset?
It wasn't price negotiation as much as variability in staffing. So, in other words, you're rather than having your own employees handle these large bulk transactions that may come in a lumpy fashion, you may have an awful lot to do at one time and then not so much to do at other times, as opposed to flow, which may be more steady. So, in terms of just managing staff and expense, it would make sense to outsource that type of activity.
And Tom, I thought I heard you phrase the question about what was sampled and kind of what went over the bridge as opposed to what went under it. Are you satisfied with that?
You got a follow-up.
Well, if you're doing a 10% sample, I guess 90% is getting through unsampled, 10% is getting sampled. I'm interested in maybe, you know, that 10% gets kicked out, and irrespective of what Clayton has, let's just say it's all out, but 90% of it, if it's a good sample, it's present in the same percentage in the 90% unsampled portion.
That's why I said when we do a sample, we say if we have exceptions or error rates,
mm-hmm.
more than 3% of the sample, we would expand the sample. We would do more work.
How much would you increase the sample?
We would probably do like another 10%. It would depend on the error rate, quite frankly.
I seem to recall you saying that a seller wouldn't be happy with that, however, on it.
You know, it's kind of, that's beside the point. I mean, always when we would do the confirmations on a bulk or even in, you know, the discussions when we talk about our process, we would be very clear about that. You know, you do a sample is only as good as the result of the sample. So to the extent that you're finding an error rate, to your point, if you kicked out the entire sample, you shouldn't buy the pool.
Right.
Or you should just look at every single one and pick the ones that you want.
Right. And in the interviews I've done, I am a former auditor. I came in with that expectation, but I haven't found it other than maybe here today.
I'm surprised by that.
Yeah. And I guess some of the reasons posted for it were, well, it was a competitive market, and we didn't want to tick off the seller. We wanted to still have these tapes come to us. We still wanted to be invited to bid. But you're saying today, no, that wasn't the case with EMC or Bear.
Correct. That to everything that I was involved in the entire time I was there, that was never the case.
And routinely, when there were error rates or reject rates above 3% or so, their expanded samples.
Yes.
Expanded
samples. Yes.
I know a little bit, based on some discussions that I've had in this building before, about the compensation package at Bayer. My understanding is that it was a $250,000 base sometime, and it changed from $200,000 to $250,000.
Plus a bonus. Managing director.
Sorry?
For senior,
that's
senior
right,
executive.
That's right.
That was the maximum base anybody could get paid.
Can you tell us a little bit about your methodology of being compensated? I'm not really interested in how much you made. I just want to know the methodology.
Yeah, a base salary and then a discretionary bonus. And from time to time, a portion of the discretionary bonus would be paid in restricted stock, in stock options, and cash. And the relative percentages change depending on the overall compensation level and from year to year.
Did the stock vest in 5 years?
For senior managing directors, it did. Actually, it may have vested in 3 and you couldn't get it for 5 or something like that. And then for other employees, I think it vested over 3.
I neglected the most obvious question. What was your title at Bear Stearns?
At the end, a senior managing director.
Okay. Do you have any?
We only touched on rating agencies, and I was interested just how they fit into this. What was their interplay with the process that you described?
The rating agencies did a number of things. One is, to the extent that EMC was the servicer for the loans, they came and did a servicer review of EMC. I don't know if it was annual, but it certainly was every 2 years, if not annual. And that involved gathering a lot of data about the servicing operation and coming on site and interviewing the line managers, et cetera. So that was quite an involved process. And EMC was rated as a subprime servicer, a special servicer, and a residential mortgage servicer by Fitch, Moody's, and S&P. They also, as part of that presentation, we would present the processes that we used in the flow conduit and in the bulk conduit in general for how we approved sellers and how we did the due diligence and how we did quality control reviews. So that was presented to them as well. And then S&P in particular published their levels model. And we used their levels model to help us calculate the price adjustments that I described for the Alt-A rate sheet. So for in other words, you would put in attributes that would be your base loan, primary residence, full dock, single family detached house, 80 LTV, let's say, and that would tell you what credit enhancement you needed for AAA for that loan. Then you would compare that to running the same thing except it was stated income.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd look at the difference in the AAA levels, ascribe a value to that difference, and that's how you could approximate what it was worth to you and that price adjustment. So we used the levels model to construct that risk-based pricing that we offered to flow sellers.
And this was iterative?
Yes.
Okay, so people at EMC or at Bayer are talking to the managing director at one of the rating agencies?
No, you could just use the model.
You could just use the model, yeah. And its output.
Yeah.
Kind of a naive question, I apologize up front, but I really don't know. If you reject something from a pool, you talked earlier about scratch and dent.
Yes.
Would that be statused as a scratch and dent because it's a reject, or it had to have some impairment? That loan had to actually be in a non-pay status for a while to be statused as a scratch and dent?
It didn't have to be in non-pay to be statused as a scratch and dent.
If it gets jacked from a pool, it could be considered a scratch and dent?
It could be, yeah, and you would typically want to know the defect. I mean, in an extreme case, let's say I kicked a loan out because I only go to 95 CLTV to 500,000 and this is 550, somebody else might buy it as a good loan. They just may have a different risk tolerance than me. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a scratch and dent, but if there's some sort of defect, it doesn't have to be non-performing to be scratch and dent.
That's all I have.
I have no more.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Very much appreciated.
All right, we're going to